Chapter 1.
My name is Gray, Richard Gray. Some people call me by the nickname Dick, especially when things are going badly, but I just hate that nickname. So if you don't know what to call me, don't call me at all. I grew up in Verchères, on the banks of the St. Lawrence River, downstream from Montreal. By the time I was 7, my mother Augusta had gone away. My father Reginald told me she was exhausted and needed a rest. During her long absence, the image of my mother merged with the waters flowing by our house. I would often go down to the riverbank and sit on my favorite rock, Grosse Pierre, so I could talk to her alone. By the way, Grosse Pierre means big rock in French. There were chestnut trees on our back lawn leading down to the river, silver maples and cottonwood, a Chinese elm tree, wild thyme, and goldenrod. In moments like that, sitting there, I felt my mother and I were together again. I would sit there on Grosse Pierre, watching geese, ducks, and herons swim back and forth against the backdrop of Marie Island. I would also watch cargo ships and tankers passing. Storms churning up the water, the passage of the seasons, ice flows in winter, and ice jams in spring. I was pretty much left to fend for myself in those years, but there was so much for a little boy to investigate along the river. Then I would head back up to the white clapboard house we lived in, a two-story house with a tin sheet roof and a sagging wraparound porch. The front door faced inland and was bright red. The back door, my door, faced the river and was bright blue. I was quite happy to open that blue door each day and go down to my rock to talk to my mother. But then, a few months after my mother left us, I remember I was 7 years old. Something really terrible happened. Something that disrupted my entire universe. Nothing would ever be the same again. My father was tall and balding and worked for one of the transcontinental railways based in Montreal, the Canadian Northern. He tried explaining to me what his job was, drawing on his pipe.
Well, I connect manufacturers to their clients, treating the country as a land bridge and combining road, rail, sea and air transport.
I was too young to understand what he was saying. I mainly watched the expression in his slate-gray eyes. He always seemed agitated. He had a faraway look. It was a strange combination. Maybe he was anxious about something. Maybe he was anxious about my mother, Augusta. I never really knew. I remember my father was always sitting behind his newspaper, the Montreal Standard. He rarely came out from behind the newspaper. He would sit there. I would hear him pouring himself a beer. I would hear him turning the pages, commenting on news stories. Sometimes he tuned his shortwave radio. He was restless.
There's just nothing on the radio,
he would mutter to himself, sucking on his pipe.
Nothing worth listening to.
He never settled on anything in particular. He would start reading something, then turn the page. He would start listening to something, then fiddle with the radio dial. When I wanted to speak to him, I had to reach around behind his newspaper and try to engage him on subjects that interested him. The main adult in the house, after my mother went away to rest, was my 74-year-old grandmother, Blanche Grieve. She would often come up from Cape Cod to take over in my mother's absence. She would stay a few weeks at a time, then return to the Cape. Frankly, I was afraid of Grandmother Grieve, and so was my father. She had long snow-white hair. When she got angry, the white hairs on her upper lip would bristle, and her milky blue eyes would darken. She smelt really bad.
"Why, there's nothing like the Saturday Evening Post," she would say. "You know, Richard, I just love playing solitaire, hours on end. Keeps my mind clear."
One time I was sitting with Grandmother Grieve in our living room, a room bathed in sunlight with heaps of old French-Canadian pine furniture.
"Why, I just won at cards 3 times in a row," Grandmother proclaimed with a triumphant sigh.
But I'd been watching her out of the corner of my eye, and I was quite sure she'd been cheating. Solitaire seemed a pointless game to me. The only way you could win was by cheating against yourself. Grandmother Grieve had definite opinions about everything. She was very set in her ways. One of her favorite expressions was,
"We are the Grieves of Griefton."
I pictured Grieve Town as an actual place way out on Cape Cod, where everyone walked around wearing black and looking sad, but I didn't remember ever having been there.
"Why, once your grandfather Grieve died," she said, "I took over the big cedar shingle house on the ocean, you know, Griefton, and I lived there alone with my older brother Jebediah, except for when I come up to Montreal to take care of you all. Jebediah's a retired Episcopalian bishop, but he's getting on in years, so I don't want to leave him alone for too long. Now, Richard, being a Grieve of Griefton means we have certain rights which other people don't. It also means society expects us to maintain a higher standard of behavior. Everyone is watching to see what we do next."
Grandmother Grieve was so old now that she sometimes forgot important things. Knowing she was a Grieve of Griefton, even if only by marriage, seemed to anchor her in reality. Grandfather Caleb Grieve had been a missionary in China, but he had died long before. We always heard about my mother's side of the family, the Grieves, but we didn't know anything about my father's side, the Greys. This made family discussions lopsided, but there was total silence from Father Reginald about his side of the family.
"Where are the Grieves from?" Father said,
puffing on his pipe and pouring himself another beer.
"Don't know much about it. I don't really remember my parents. I lost them both at an early age and was raised by nuns in an orphanage. I would rather not talk about it."
I didn't like taking baths. Sometimes I would run a bath, then swish the water back and forth with my hand, pretending to get into it.
"Richard Gray,"
I would hear Grandmother Grieve coming in from the next room.
"Just look at you, filthy."
"No, Grandmother, that's clean dirt."
"Now get into that bath this very instant."
Actually, I was afraid to take baths. If I closed my eyes for a moment, I would imagine a rusty old canal boat bearing down on me at full speed, smoke billowing out of its tall, narrow smokestack, right there in the bathtub. I eventually turned this into a game, closing my eyes and counting to 10 as I sat in the bathtub to get over my fear of ships from the St. Lawrence River coming to drown me. I knew that ships could sink, and I pictured them crashing through the walls of our house and pushing their bows into my bathtub. My brother Andrew was 3 years older than me, skinny and very secretive. He had curly red hair, a tight, unsmiling face, twitchy eyes, and a scrunched-up nose when he got tense. He liked playing on our out-of-tune ruin of an upright piano in the corner of the living room. He was always discovering things about people.
Please mind the gap between the platform and the train.
I remember Father Reginald made a lot of business trips to London, England, where the railway had offices on Cockspur Street. But on returning home, Father would receive personal letters from somebody in England, letters that smelled funny. He would hide them as soon as he came in the front door, but Andrew figured out how to steam them open and glue them shut again. And that's when we found out Father Reginald, our father, was meeting up with an English lady friend on his business trips. She seemed very fond of him, according to the letters. What did this all mean? My sister Florence by now was 13 years old. She kept fretting about her appearance. Do you like my blonde hair, Grandmother Grieve? I've done it up in a hairstyle called the Beautiful Mess. That's a hairstyle in France, where women want to look just like Brigitte Bardot. Am I pretty? Sister Florence was always telling me what to do. Was she trying to take the place of my mother? No, I think she was actually like a younger version of Grandmother Grieve, just as pushy. Florence was always collecting things. Her room was like a museum containing everything she had turned up on the riverbank behind our house. Earthworms, beetles, frogs. She kept them in jars and glass tanks. She didn't mind the smell of all these creeping, crawling, and fluttering little creatures. Anyway, one day, Florence went for a walk in the forest. She came back home with a stray kitten. It was dirty and full of worms and very sick. Maybe it was going to die, but it was an adorable little thing, crawling up under her sweater, purring with delight as she patted it. The kitten got dewormed and recovered. It prowled around the house like a giant tiger in the jungle. It had the most incredible talent for make-believe. The kitten soon learned what a can opener was for. I buy canned food, said Grandmother Grieve, because I just hate cooking. Why, every time I open a tin of tuna, that kitten races to the kitchen and coils itself around my ankle, insinuating itself, begging for something to eat. A year went by. Somehow, the kitten had grown and grown, and now it occupied every single room in the house. For me, the cat had become the house, something the way my mother had become the St. Lawrence River. Every time I walked outside, I imagined walls of fur filling up the front door and windows, and even coming out of the chimney. I didn't understand why, but coming inside the house made it hard for me to breathe. I began staying out on the riverbank for longer periods of time. I caught nasty chest colds, one after the other. Grandmother Grieve finally called the doctor, who still made house calls in those years, and the doctor suggested I go to the hospital for tests. The best allergist was Dr. Maureen Corker at the Montreal General Hospital. We got into the family car, a rusty old blue Ford Falcon. It was winter. Grandmother Grieve was getting on in years, and her driving scared me. When she was distracted, she drove in a kind of zigzag motion. The police stopped us. She explained everything to them and they let us go. I crouched in the passenger seat, hoping we would make it safely to our destination. It took us a good hour to get to the hospital in Montreal.
Dr. Maureen Corker, you're wanted in immunology. Dr. Maureen Corker.
The hospital was a big, unfriendly place. Everyone looked so miserable and it smelled strange. We waited the longest time. Grandmother Grieve played solitaire on the chair next to her. Then Dr. Corker finally came. She furrowed her brows and scowled as if on the point of announcing imminent disaster. I bravely rolled up my shirt sleeve as she brought over a steel tray covered with needles and 80 bottles. She pricked 80 holes in my arm, introducing bits of fur and pollen and other stuff to see what I reacted to. Half an hour later, my arm was all puffy. "Mrs. Grieve," Dr. Corker said, "we've done the tests. And your grandson has asthma. In fact, he's allergic to quite a few different things on my list. Goats, sheep, horses, rabbits, ragweed, dust, dogs, cats. So, do you have a kitten at home? A cat? My advice to you is, consider your options. Either get rid of the cat, or..." She didn't finish the sentence. I felt darkness closing in on me, as if I were entering a tunnel. I started wheezing. Was the doctor actually suggesting my family should get rid of me?
"Asthma. Oh, goodness, Dick," said Grandmother Grieve. "This is a problem. Nobody in the family has ever had asthma before."
Then it dawned on her.
"The cat. Poor little thing. Well, this is going to create problems."
I was sometimes Richard, but now that I was causing trouble, Grandmother was back to calling me Dick. We drove home. Driving again was a hair-raising experience. She had one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brakes, and veered to the left, then to the right, as if the way home were one long, maddening obstacle course.
"I'm calling a family council," Grandmother Grieve announced on entering the doorway. Brother Andrew got up from the out-of-tune upright piano and came over to join Sister Florence and me at the dinner table. Father Reginald remained impassive behind his newspaper, as usual. The cat lay purring on a woven rag carpet next to the cast-iron stove from Nova Scotia. "We are the Greaves of Grieveton," said Grandmother Grieve. "Dr. Corker says Dick has asthma. This is a nasty condition which involves inflammation of the airwaves, so he has trouble breathing. I've looked into the matter," she went on. "According to a recent article in the Saturday Evening Post, asthma is often psychosomatic. Psychosomatic. That means it may be caused by stress or anxiety and is merely a way of getting attention. So, when Dick gets upset about things, his asthma just gets worse and worse."
Clearly, there was something seriously the matter with me. Would I return to the hospital as an invalid, like my mother? Just then, I felt an asthma attack coming on.
"Dr. Corker says Dick is allergic to the cat. Now, this is through no fault on the cat's part." "Gracious, no. It's just a fact of life. The doctor says we should either get rid of the cat or..."
Sister Florence and Brother Andrew began kicking me under the table. I couldn't help filling in the rest of the sentence. Were they willing to get rid of the cat, or were they planning to get rid of me?
"This is not an either-or situation," continued Grandmother Grieve. "We must be fair. We must be democratic. We must offer a solution to everyone." "Children, this is a large enough house. Not as large as Grieve House in Grieveton, mind you."
Here she cast a disapproving glance at Father Reginald, reading the newspaper.
"But large enough. I realize how dearly you children love the cat, so I propose we keep him in the TV room in the basement. Dick can stay in his room upstairs, overlooking the river. If he has asthma because he watches TV, then he can read books in his room instead. Reading is good for the mind. Why, At his age, I read voraciously. Louisa May Alcott, Joseph Conrad, W.H. Hudson. There's lots of books to read, all quite appropriate for someone his age. Remember, democracy is what makes America great. That's right. But, wait a moment. We're actually in Canada. Yes, but we should still be democratic about this, even in Canada. I propose we take a vote and let the majority win.
Just then, the cat jumped up onto Sister Florence's lap and glared at me. The votes were counted. 2 votes for the cat and 1 vote for me. I lost. The cat won. The cat loomed large in my life. It was making me really sick. It had the power of life and death over me like a despot, an ogre. This was my first truly resounding defeat in life, all because of the tyranny of the majority. Grandmother Grieve was convinced the best solution was keeping the cat while sending me to my room. But from my point of view, this solution was worse than the problem. The cat refused to stay in just one room. It insinuated itself into every other room in the house. My sister and brother were constantly playing with it, and they carried cat hair on their clothes all over the house. My issues with the cat gave them a very strong reason to dislike me. For a time, I stopped watching TV altogether and read Joseph Conrad in my room. His descriptions of the sea reminded me of the glittering St. Lawrence, its murmuring waters blurred by a creeping mist. Grandmother Grieve also let me listen to a little portable transistor radio in my room. Sometimes, late at night when I couldn't sleep, I turned the dial on the little radio. I always listened in French, as if I were drawn into a fantasy conversation with the female radio hosts. I wondered whether I was listening to the same stations as my father in the living room downstairs. Maybe Father Reginald and I were remotely connected somehow. The cat was always getting into mischief. Sister Florence tried explaining it had to leave her collection of creepy crawly animals alone, but the cat wouldn't listen. It knocked the jars of earthworms and beetles onto the floor, then climbed into the frog tank. It ate every single animal in her collection, then collapsed on Florence's quilt blanket and threw up all over it. Grandmother Grieve, I pleaded a few months later. I go to school now. My classmates at school are always making fun of me. They say the Montreal Canadiens are the greatest hockey team in history, but I don't know any of the players. They say I'm just stupid. She said, the white hairs on her upper lip bristling with irritation, pondering the solution to this problem. I knew just what to do. Dick, come with me. We got into the car and drove a good hour to the corner of McGill Street and Notre Dame Street in Old Montreal. We entered an army surplus store. I was amazed to see all the paraphernalia in the display cases. Submachine guns, pistols, swords, hunting knives, old hand grenades. There was even a Nazi helmet with a bullet hole through it. I wondered if it had been taken off a corpse in a trench somewhere. On the counter were heaps of dusty old Air Force and Army uniforms.
Oui, madame, said a thin little salesman with long greasy black hair and dirty fingernails. What can I do for you?
I need a gas mask, said Grandmother Grieve.
May I ask what for? Asked the salesman.
It's for my grandson, so he can watch TV.
Oui, I see. Well, I have a British Mark IV.
The salesman rifled through the drawers under the counter and pulled out something long and dark. It was a thick rubber mask
with enormous glass eyepieces set in the fabricized rubber, a central speech diaphragm with a long tube coming out of it that connected to a purple canister which had an asbestos filter in it. The salesman pulled it over my face, adjusting the elastic bands around the back of my head to keep it in place. "The gas mask is $15, said the salesman, "but will your grandson walk around wearing the gas mask? If so, he will need the canvas tote bag, which I can offer you for just $2 more." I said. We got back into the car. I was still wearing the gas mask. Suddenly, I realized this meant war. I pictured myself in epic combat, boy versus cat. After being outflanked, I was now empowered. I was going to be able to reclaim ownership of my home. What was the cat to me? Grandmother Grieve said I could watch the hockey game that very evening, or at least the first period. The Montreal Canadiens were facing the Toronto Maple Leafs. "Don't forget the gas mask," she said, by way of encouragement. My father sat behind his newspaper, as usual. Our clapboard house had originally been built on slabs of stone, but then my father decided to have the house raised on stilts so foundations could be dug, which meant we had extra living space in the basement. I went down to the TV room, which was poorly lit. The TV room had a dusty old cloth-covered sofa and funky orange plastic fishnet curtains going up the wall to little windows that had been nailed shut. I sat down in between Sister Florence and Brother Andrew. The television set was an old Zenith mounted on brass peg legs. The cat liked to sit on top of it because it was always warm there. I didn't know hockey well, but I was enjoying the game.
Here's Red Kelly of the Leafs, breaking out over the red line. But oh, John Ferguson of the Canadiens whacks him. That looks like boarding, but the referee doesn't call it. Kelly now, getting up again, skates off to the Leafs bench. Centerman Dave Kuhn takes his place for Toronto.
What's happening?
I asked. I couldn't follow the action because the glass eyepieces were fogging up.
Shut up, Dick, said Andrew, punching me. Here's Montreal goalie Gemp Worsley, retrieving the puck from behind the net. He passes it out to defenseman Jean-Claude Tremblay. Tremblay passes up to Jean Béliveau. A long flick shot. That's Tremblay's specialty. The Toronto player's in disarray.
What's happening?
Now Béliveau, stick handling. On a breakaway, over the blue line into the Toronto zone, goalie Johnny Bauer skating backwards, reaching out with broad shoulders to keep everything covered. Béliveau dicks him and shoots the puck. He scores! Jean Béliveau, a goal for Montreal.
I was breathing so heavily now that the cat, sitting on the television set, freaked out, arching its back and hissing, then jumped up onto the orange fishnet curtains and clawed its way higher in desperation.
Shut up and get out of here, shouted Sister Florence and Brother Andrew.
Dick, you're wrecking everything. I fled to my bedroom.
I flung off the gas mask. It was winter and I didn't care. I felt humiliated. I opened the windows and let the river air blow into the room, covering the windowsill with a powdering of fresh snowflakes. The St. Lawrence hadn't frozen yet and sent short waves rushing onto the shore in the darkness. I listened to the rest of the game on the radio.
Over the years, I occasionally watched television, but I had to wear the gas mask each time. I also wore it on occasion in the living room, for example, by the cast iron stove when the cat was napping next to it. From that moment, my perspective on life changed. The gas mask shielded me not just from cat fur, but from other people who could no longer see how I felt about things. And for my part, I could barely guess where other people were at because I now saw the world through glass eyepieces, which tended to fog up. I remember watching the investiture of Prince Charles as Prince of Wales.
I, Charles, Prince of Wales, do become your liege man.
It was a very moving occasion.
And of earthly worship. And faith and truth I will bear unto thee to live.
Here were the regalia bearers coming into the Chamberlain Tower at Carnarvon Castle, awaiting the arrival of Queen Elizabeth. Other members of the royal family sat down. Now the Earl of Snowdon, the Lord Great Chamberlain, the Earl Marshal, and the gentleman usher carrying the great sword of state came up onto the stage, leading the Queen and Duke of Edinburgh. Prince Charles knelt before his mother, the Queen, who invested him solemnly with a girdle, sword, ring, coronet. As I sat there watching the spectacle with my gas mask on, I wondered when my mother would come home again. Mother Augusta was still away. They said she was still suffering from exhaustion. I hoped she would be back soon. Perhaps she would come home, bearing me a ceremonial gift, the way the Queen was doing for Prince Charles.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
A few weeks later, I watched the Apollo 11 mission on television. The kitten was by now definitely a mature, overweight cat and was usually outside hunting for mice or birds. Sometimes it didn't come home for days at a time, but cat fur lingered everywhere inside the house. My gas mask smelt of dust and asbestos fibers. Here was Mission Commander Neil Armstrong, assuring Mission Control Center in Houston that all systems were go. The astronauts were traveling to the moon. They were explorers, pioneers, going where no human had ever gone before. They were boldly setting out for another world. Then Neil Armstrong said what it felt like to step down the ladder of the lunar module onto the surface of the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Seeing Neil Armstrong with his space suit and space helmet, I was no longer alone. I was part of something bigger than myself. I felt a special kinship with the astronaut program. I had the right stuff. I had a cause. I maybe even had a mission. I was an explorer too, in my own way. Perhaps one day I would discover a new world, a place where nobody else had ever been. Sometimes the asthma got so bad, I had to get an injection of adrenaline at Dr. Corker's office. Adrenaline is a hormone taken from the adrenal gland of cows. When I got the injection, I felt like a racehorse. Eventually, the asthma attack subsided, and I could go home again. I remember watching a movie on TV. I was quite alone, sitting there in the basement with my gas mask on. Raquel Welch was playing a prehistoric cave woman called Luana in 1 million years BC. She had that big 1960s hair. She was just gorgeous. She had a voluptuous figure and a fur bikini that left nothing to the imagination. She was an intellectual wearing little fur boots. She had everything a man could ever desire, beauty and brains. Even the animated dinosaurs and giant sea turtle in the movie wanted her. I watched Raquel Welch through my thick goggles. I watched her bouncing across the screen. I watched her in the wet scene and the fight scene with other shapely young women in fur bikinis of their own. But my glass eyepieces started steaming up. I was breathing heavily now. I couldn't help wondering whether I would one day meet a woman like Raquel Welch. Would I have to keep the gas mask on? Would she be able to understand what I was saying with my muffled voice? And what if I tried kissing her? How would that work? It seemed like the gas mask was a barrier, closing me off in my own world, preventing me from intimacy with other people. As things turned out, I would continue wearing it until I reached the age of 15. I remember 7 years of watching occasional television shows through those thick goggles or glass eyepieces. 7 years gasping for air inside an echo chamber. No wonder I usually listened to the radio in my bedroom. By now, some of our neighbors were complaining about the cat. They claimed the cat bit and scratched their children, who had to defend themselves with sticks. At least, that's what the neighbors said. I wonder. Grandmother Grieve was older now. She remembered a little less than before. She didn't remember how to do things, but oh boy, she was still driving the car. She said we should put the cat on a leash and tie it up to the little Chinese elm tree outside so it could get some fresh air. One day, I returned from school and glanced over at the Chinese elm tree to see how the cat was doing. Imagine my horror at discovering the cat, stiff as a board, dangling from an upper branch, the leash tight around its neck. What had gone through the cat's mind? The cat had hanged itself. It was as dead as a doornail. It had given up the ghost. Grandmother Grieve came out of the house. There was a fresh wind off the river, which made a mess of her long white hair. There were tears in her milky blue eyes.
"We're going to hold a funeral this very evening," Grandmother said, "and bury the cat in the backyard."
My father returned from work at the railway and settled down behind his newspaper, as usual. Sister Florence and Brother Andrew sobbed as the cat was laid in a cardboard box. They carried the cat in a sad procession to a hole they had dug in the backyard and buried it, right by my favorite rock on the riverbank. I watched from my window. Maybe this was the beginning of a new era, I wondered. But no, Grandmother Grieve bought them a new kitten the next day. My father slammed the door on kitten number 2 by mistake, so Grandmother Grieve bought them kitten number 3 a few days later. One day, my mother Augusta got better. And she came home. I could tell you about the way my mother and I went down by the riverbank to get reacquainted after her long absence, sitting on my rock and watching the river flow by. But I will tell you about that another time.